You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. This is Carmen Gomez Galisteo, and today I have the pleasure to have with me Fiona Gregory, who is the author of Ask Crises and Mental Illness. Thank you, Fiona, for joining us today, and welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Carmen. It's wonderful to have this opportunity.
So I wanted to introduce you. Fiona Gregory is a lecturer in the Centre for Theatre and Performance at Monash University in Melbourne, and her research on the history of the arts crisis has appeared in leading journals, including New Theatre Quarterly and 19th Century Theatre and Film. And as I was saying, today we are going to speak about her latest book, Arts Crisis and Mental Illness. So in your book, you choose six arts crises, Mrs. Patrick Campbell, Peck and Whistle, Dorothy Hale, Diana Barrymore, Vivian Leigh, and Frances Farmer. So what made you choose these particular six actresses?
Well, they each came into the project, I guess, at different times and in slightly different ways. I actually wrote my PhD dissertation on Mrs. Patrick Campbell, and she was an actress who she started her career in the 1880s. And for my PhD, I was researching her career in its entirety, really, which was how I first encountered her Ophelia. And it stayed in my mind and made me wonder about other actresses who might have had experiences of mental illness or psychiatric treatment and the impact that that might have had on their career or their celebrity. So I kind of held that in my mind for a while. And obviously that brought up examples such as Vivian Leigh and Frances Farmer, who are kind of the obvious examples, I guess. But I also wanted to balance the analysis with some lesser known performers, which is what led me to people such as Peg Entwistle. And I wanted to examine some specific experiences, such as the experience of addiction, which brought me to Diana Barrymore.
Was it difficult to research for this book? Because mental illness is something that people try to hide, especially in earlier periods. So maybe it is not so well documented that now we have actresses talking openly about it or being exposed in tabloids or the like.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's not a topic that lends itself to straightforward research or traditional research methods. Most archives don't hold medical information. They don't hold medical records. There might be the odd letter here and there from a doctor, or the mention of someone having treatment, but that kind of information isn't generally held in traditional archives. So it was a matter of realizing that what I was looking for wasn't necessarily going to be spelt out, and that I'd need to consider subtext and also cast a wide net, so look more broadly at colleagues and peers and family and friends and any kind of material that they might have contributed. And it was also interesting that with this kind of topic, material such as rumor and anecdote actually became quite useful as a starting off point. But of course, you can't take that kind of material at face value. You obviously have to test it.
And for instance, in the book, you mentioned that Mrs. Campbell, she was considered to be miscast as Ophelia in Hamlet because she brought another dimension into the conventional way in which Ophelia was portrayed. Her Ophelia was kind of depressed. So how was this influenced by her own experience with mental illness? Do you think she brought something of her experience into the role?
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting question, and it's a question that it's difficult to give a firm answer to, because it wasn't really something that she commented on. And I mentioned earlier that I wrote my PhD on her, on Mrs. Patrick Campbell, but in that project I was very focused on her performance in a specific role that she played in 1893, which was Paula Tanqueray in a play called The Second Mrs. Tanqueray by Arthur Wing Pinero. And in that role she really appeared as a perfect representation of the modern woman of the 1890s. It was seen to be, you know, a really timely representation of the contemporary woman. And that was very much linked to the way that Campbell played it. When I read later accounts of her career, they would all speak at length about her success as Paula, but would mention that she wasn't a very good Shakespearean actress. And when I looked at the contemporary evidence, there did seem to be very many lukewarm, sometimes even negative reviews of her performances in Shakespeare's plays, but there were also a few, especially of Ophelia, that weren't just positive, they were glowing, absolutely glowing about the effect that she'd had on the audience or the impression that she'd made. So I wanted to try and account for that disparity, the fact that she'd gone down in history as someone who couldn't play Shakespeare, and yet here and there were the odd reviews that said she was doing something really interesting and different in some of her Shakespearean performances, and specifically her Ophelia, and that her approach to Ophelia was quite original. And then I discovered that 2 months before she began rehearsals for Ophelia, she had spent 2 months in a psychiatric nursing home. She'd had some kind of what was referred to as a breakdown. She was very overworked at the time. She also had some difficulties in her personal life, and she had been quite physically unwell. So she went to this nursing home and she was given what was called the rest cure. The rest cure was a treatment that was developed in the 19th century by an American neurologist named Silas Weir Mitchell, and it's most famously represented by Charlotte Perkins Gilman in her domestic horror story, The Yellow Wallpaper. And during the rest cure, the patient is required to stay in bed. They're not even allowed to sit up. They are subjected to repeated feeding, so they're almost overfed. They're not allowed any form of stimulation. They're not allowed to even look out a window. They certainly can't read or write. They can't have any visitors. and they're kept under constant surveillance. So this is the treatment that Campbell was given when she went to the psychiatric nursing home. And it's supposed to ease the nerves and enable the patient to recover and return to normal life. But it left Campbell feeling quite shattered. She became very anxious and overwrought. And it's that experience of being kind of on edge, of being under surveillance and of feeling very despairing and unsupported that she seems to have channeled into her Ophelia. At this time, Victorian audiences were very used to seeing Ophelias who were very pretty. They would laugh and sing and cry, and they would make the audience feel very sorry for her, feel very sorry for this character and her predicament. And Campbell's Ophelia did something very different. It bewildered the audience because she was so vacant. Some commentators described her eyes as looking out into the audience as if there was nothing behind them. And it was a performance that was very given in a very flat affect. And rather than making an audience pity her, it made them kind of shudder at her. So they were profoundly bewildered by it, but I think it was definitely marked by, if not her experience of breakdown, then certainly her experience of the rescuer and the kind of treatment that she had received in that period in the nursing home. And it was something that Victorian audiences weren't prepared for.
Yeah, definitely the treatment was terrible. Yeah, because imagine, being in bed for so long without doing anything. So, wow.
A complete being left with your own thoughts, which was not what she needed at that time.
Yeah, probably not, because I think that it makes everything even worse rather than lessen your problems. And then next in your book, you speak about Peck and Whistle, that maybe she's less popular. If we say the name, when I read the name, I was like, who is she? Yeah, but then we say, oh, she's the actress who jumped to her death from the Hollywood Land Sign. So then everybody will know who she is because of this urban legend. Well, it's not a legend, it's true, but there are so many stories about her. So apart from her death that make her so famous, what was her story as a young actress trying to become famous in Hollywood at the time while having a mental illness? Because, for instance, you mentioned that in newspapers she's portrayed as a failed actress, desperate for work and driven by despair and depression, but you show that despite the great depression and everything, she continued working as an actress.
Yeah, look, I discovered so much that I didn't know about Peg Entwistle. Like, I mean, as you've described there, I had exactly the same kind of response. I only really knew of her as the actress who jumped from the Hollywood Sign. But when I looked into her career and her life, she's actually an incredibly interesting figure and one who made some significant achievements in a very short life. She was only 24 when she died. And obviously the reason that she's passed into history is due to the manner of her death. So on September 16, 1932, she climbed the Hollywood Sign and she fell to her death. And because she was living in Hollywood at the time and she had only made one film, the newspapers picked up her story and kind of turned her into an archetype of the failed actress. So she became representative of the young woman who comes to Hollywood, desperate to make it in the movies, but is undone in the process. And so she came to function as a kind of a cautionary tale, I guess, or a warning. And there have been many, many, many movies, television shows, novels, songs, which have picked up her story and used that archetype. But as I mentioned before, what's intriguing is that the meanings that she's taken on after her death, which are all about failure and misfortune and a lack of talent, are very different and not reflective of her lived experience. She actually had quite a distinguished stage career. She was born in Wales in 1908, but her family moved to the US when she was very young. She had quite an unsettled childhood. Her parents separated, and then her father died when she was quite young. But she had a very good education, and she began acting in her mid-teens, and she soon got work with some of the most established companies in Boston. And she was working with major names of the American stage, people like Blanche Yoker, Ethel Barrymore, Walter Hampton. She was playing on Broadway before she was 20. She had a lead role in a Broadway production that ran for over 300 performances. This is a career that is marked by significant achievements, but also constant stresses. So she was starting her career in the late 1920s, and these were very difficult years to be looking for work. Even for the most established performers, you could be out of work for months, if not years. There were many out-of-work actors. Shows could fold very suddenly and unexpectedly. And the fact that Peg Entwistle kept getting work in this environment is a sign of achievement, but it's a fact that was pretty much ignored after her death. We don't know why she went to Hollywood. Oh, I'm sorry. We do know why she went to Hollywood. She went to Hollywood to appear in a play. We don't know why she stayed on after that play finished. We think it was because she had found work in one film and may have been seeking work in other films. But we don't know why she chose to do that rather than returning to Broadway. So her career is marked by some significant achievements, but the idea of her as a wannabe actress whose sense of failure is so extreme that she feels compelled to perform this extraordinary, spectacular suicide was a more compelling story. And that's the story that newspapers latched onto immediately. And it's a very useful story for Hollywood as an institution, to think of Entwistle in archetypal terms rather than thinking about her as a specific individual, because it's those kind of stories that enhance the aura attached to Hollywood and make those who do succeed seem even more special.
Also in your book, next, you speak about Dorothy Hale, who is best remembered for the Frida Kahlo painting. But the story of the painting is also very peculiar because it was almost destroyed by one of Hale's friends, by Booth. So what is the story of the suicide and the painting and everything that surrounded it?
Dorothy Hale, is kind of similar to Peg Entwistle in some ways, and I've put them together in the book as examples of so-called minor actresses for whom the facts of their death have become more important than any aspect of their career. And each of them are tied to a significant landmark. So Peg Entwistle is tied to the Hollywood sign. And as you say, Dorothy Hale is tied to this extraordinary painting by Frida Kahlo. And for people who haven't seen it, I urge you to just quickly Google the suicide of Dorothy Hale, Frida Kahlo, and you will see this extraordinary picture that was created Unlike Entwistle, Hale didn't have an extensive performing background. She didn't hone her acting skills in touring companies, for example, as Entwistle did. Soon after beginning her career, she married and became part of New York society. And it was only after her second husband died that she decided to try and resurrect her performance career. But it seems that she wasn't really able to make the most of the opportunities that she encountered. She secured a small role in a major Hollywood film, but that didn't lead to other roles. And she was cast in the tryouts of a new New York play by Claire Booth Luce, who will come into this story shortly. But she was dropped from the cast when it moved to Broadway. So for some reason, she just didn't seem to be able to make the most of the opportunities that arose, or she wasn't in the right place at the right time. She was incredibly beautiful. People described her in later years as looking like a young Elizabeth Taylor, that kind of beauty. And she became a bit of a fixture in New York society columns as a celebrity beauty. But then in October 1938, she fell from her apartment building in Hampshire House. And Hampshire House was a very exclusive building, built in the Art Deco style. It had been built in 1931. And it was very close to Central Park. Part of the interest in her death was also related to this building. Her death was ruled a suicide and was very widely reported on. And much was made of a party that she had held on the night of her death. It was noted that she was wearing this quite spectacular evening gown when she died. After her death, Claire Booth Luce, who was a writer, she had been editor of Vanity Fair. Her husband was the editor of Time magazine, and she would later go on to make quite a name for herself as a politician. She went to the opening of Frida Kahlo's first American exhibition in New York. And she was very taken by some of the self-portraits that Kahlo was exhibiting there. And she asked Kahlo if she would paint a kind of memorial portrait of Dorothy Hale, which Booth could give to Hale's mother. And Kahlo accepted the commission. However, when the painting arrived at Claire Booth Luce's house, she was absolutely horrified and attempted to destroy it, which she was prevented from doing so. She had expected a conventional memorial portrait, something that captured the celebrated beauty of her friend, but that is not what Frida Kahlo gave her. What Frida Kahlo gave her was a representation of Hale's suicide. So we see Hampshire House and it looms in the painting, surrounded by clouds. And then we see Hale at three moments as a tiny figure in the top of the painting, leaving the apartment, as a slightly larger figure falling through the air, upright, and then as a larger figure still, lying on a patch of earth that looks a bit like a stage and staring lifelessly at the viewer. And she's wearing the spectacular evening gown that had been described in the newspaper columns. And Booth was furious, bewildered, and she immediately began working to remove all associations that she had had with the painting. And she tried to have the painting suppressed. She wasn't successful in doing that, but she certainly removed all of her association with it. And so Dorothy Hale passes into history through Carlo's painting. So the meanings that are attached to her become very emblematic of failure and the inability to forge a career as an actress to a point that she has become mentally unstable. That's the story that kind of circulates, that has circulated around Dorothy Hale through Carlo's painting.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I can imagine that you want a memorial, and yeah, the final result is not exactly what she had in mind, because it's a powerful painting, but then seeing your friend suicide, yeah, it's not something easy to see, and even less to give to her mother.
Exactly, but it's so curious because there were, you know, I mean, most of us have a sense of the kind of work that Carlo did, and although she did do some quite conventional self-portraits and so on, at that exhibition there were some of her more confronting body-focused works on display that Booth would have seen. So it's surprising that she didn't kind of take that into account when asking Carlo to do the portrait.
Yeah, maybe that is something. Yeah, it was like a red flag seeing the kind of works that Carlo was producing at the time. And then also you explained about Diana Barrymore. You explained that her problems, they were part of a context. They were not in isolation, because they have much to do with her family past, and also the way drinking was accepted in artistic circles at the time, right?
Yeah, that's very true. And I felt it was really important to have a chapter on addiction, because stories about actresses and addiction became increasingly prominent in the period that I was looking at, from the kind of the mid to late 19th century and through the 20th century. And they hold a particular stigma, both the actress and the addict are associated with deception. They're both kind of thought of as expert liars. So the actress who suffers from addiction is kind of doubly coded in that way. And Diana Barrymore is an interesting figure to look at, because her status as an alcoholic became the key aspect of her celebrity during her lifetime. So it wasn't something that just happened posthumously. It actually happened during her lifetime. But as you allude to, very early in her career, what was most notable about her was her family name. She was a member of the Barrymore family. Her father was John Barrymore, who was perhaps the most prominent member of the family in the early 20th century. And alongside his siblings, Lionel and Ethel, they were some of the biggest stars of the American stage. Her father, John Barrymore, was also Drew Barrymore's grandfather, which makes Diana Barrymore Drew Barrymore's aunt, although both John and Diana died long before Drew was born. John Barrymore, he was perhaps the greatest stage star of the early American of the early 20th century American stage. But by the 1930s, his career was being significantly impacted by his own alcoholism. He wasn't really involved in Diana's life as a child. She was raised by her mother, Blanche Ulrichs, who was a member of New York society, but she was also a poet who wrote under the name Michael Strange, and she was quite an eccentric. So Diana was raised by her, but she was certainly very aware of who her father was and of his career and his status, and she was herself determined to become an actress. She studied acting and she had some very strong opportunities, but her career didn't really take off. However, I believe that she did have genuine talent. She was certainly a very committed actress. Colleagues would write about how she would spend hours and hours preparing her scripts and doing analysis. However, she had this incredibly complicated personal life. She reconnected with her father and then he died shortly after. 2 months after her father's death, she made a very unsuitable marriage to a man much older than herself. Her brother, her half-brother, died of an overdose. She made two more fraught marriages. And through all of this, and perhaps as a consequence of all of this, she became increasingly dependent on alcohol. Because of her name, her personal life was fodder for the newspapers, and she had a couple of brushes with the law as a consequence of her drinking, and so she was in the public eye increasingly due to her issues with alcohol rather than anything that she was doing in her career. And it bears a lot of similarities to the kind of narrative that was built up around her niece, Drew Barrymore, 25 or 30 years ago. But Drew Barrymore was able to pull herself out of that by some very savvy professional choices. And Diana did not have that knack. It wasn't until quite late in her life, through her professional and personal association with Tennessee Williams, that she found the kind of work that matched her talents. And unfortunately, by that time, there had been a memoir. She had published a ghostwritten memoir about her life and her issues with addiction, and that memoir had been made into a film. So she was very firmly established as a celebrity addict.
My favorite chapter was the next one, the one on Vivien Leigh. That she's best remembered as Scarlett O'Hara, but being an actress who suffered from mental problems, she won her second Academy Award for portraying Blanche DuBois, who is a character with mental problems. So, how do you think her own personal history of mental problems throughout her life may have informed her performance?
It's a fascinating question, but again, it is one that's quite difficult to answer. It wasn't something that Leigh really commented on. Leigh is such an interesting figure. She's the one that I developed the most admiration for while writing this book. I think she's quite extraordinary. She drew enormous satisfaction and interest from her work. And she seems to have been able to separate her illness, she suffered from bipolar disorder, her illness from her sense of self. And it's such a pity, therefore, that in popular representations of her, that she's often over-identified with her illness. So she's described as a tragic actress or as a sad, crazy woman or as a nymphomaniac. And she undoubtedly experienced profound suffering as a consequence of her mental illness, but that wasn't the sum of her experience. And those periods of suffering, this is what I argue in the book, I argue that those periods of suffering make her achievements all the more remarkable. And not just her professional achievements, but also the achievements of her personal life. She was able to maintain very strong, healthy friendships and relationships across her life, and she had many diverse interests. When it comes to Blanche DuBois in A Streetcar Named Desire, there's often a narrative along the lines of, wasn't it foolish for this actress who was herself mentally unwell to choose to play a character who is also mentally unwell? Or that Lee is just performing her own madness in Blanche, or that she's disassociating. So those are the kinds of narratives that are often built up around her performance in Streetcar. When discussing Streetcar, it's important to remember that Vivien Leigh played Blanche on stage as well as on film. She was in the Premier UK production, and she played the role over 300 times. So this was a role that she knew really well. She seems to have focused her approach to the role on external details. So she spent a lot of time on gesture, on costume, on makeup. But she also worked on understanding Blanche psychologically. So one kind of supported the other. She was technically very proficient. She could replicate a gesture or a vocal emphasis in exactly the same way night after night after night. So she had this very structured approach to performance and to this role in particular. And that was necessary because this was a hugely demanding role. It was not just psychologically demanding, it was also very physically demanding. And it took an enormous physical toll on her. And the labor of the role may well have impacted her mental health at times. But I'm not convinced that she was, in inverted commas, made mad by playing this mad character. She had to negotiate the effects of mental illness and of psychiatric treatment throughout her career. And sometimes her work must have made this more difficult, but I believe that at times it also sustained and helped her meet the challenge of not just of mental illness, but of other personal and professional challenges.
And something that you show through the book is that, well, there are many actresses suffering from mental illness. But however, Frances Farmer, far from being the only one or even the first one, she's like the archetype, the embodiment of a mentally ill actresses. So how do you think that came to happen, that when we think mental illnesses, actresses, most of us go to Frances Farmer instead of all the others that you deal with in the book?
Yeah, you're right. She really is, you know, she's the archetype of the mentally ill actress, the mad actress. And I think there's a number of things that are making that happen. She, again, there's little published material where she reflects on on her mental illness or her psychiatric treatment, which was extensive. There was a so-called memoir, Will There Really Be a Morning, which was published in 1972, 2 years after she died, and it's a pretty dubious text. So the evidence surrounding her life is quite unstable, and that means, you know, that there's a lot of room there for a kind of alternative narrative or an untested narrative to be built up around her. She had issues with addiction as well as complex mental illness, and unfortunately, she's one of the few examples that I looked at where their experiences of illness and addiction intersected with criminal and legal forces. So she was actually arrested for public drunkenness. She was committed to an institution by law. And this was at a time when the press was taking a less deferential attitude to Hollywood studios and actors, and they were prepared to publish these kinds of stories. At the same time, Frances Farmer was not a big enough star to be protected by the studio. She didn't have strong relationships with the studios, and she wouldn't play the game. So as a consequence, she was kind of left out to dry. So photos of her resisting arrest or of appearing in court could be widely published. And that established a narrative that was then reinforced with every subsequent incident. And as well as that, Farmer had very little support. She was not good at fostering and maintaining strong and supportive relationships. She had little family support. Her family were at times implicated in having her subjected to forms of treatment that she did not want to be subjected to. These forms of treatment weren't particularly useful. And she also had ongoing issues with addiction, and all of that made her story very public. And with the publication of her memoir in the early 1970s, it generated further interest in her. And that was at a time when the anti-psychiatric movement was gaining traction, and it enabled her to be positioned as a victim of psychiatry and also as a kind of anti-establishment poster child, you know, because she had she'd been subjected to psychiatric treatment against her will, but she'd also been subjected to the forces of Hollywood as an institution and to the law. So she takes on this kind of aura, this anti-establishment aura as well, which generates a lot of interest in her, and she becomes a kind of a pop cultural icon as well.
And would you say that now actresses with mental illnesses, they suffer from the same stigma as these actresses here? Because often we see news pieces about young actresses who suffer from mental illness, and their problems are all over the internet and going to rehab and going into treatment and having relapses for everybody to see and comment upon. So do you think that there is still this stigma, this aura about actresses and mental illness or not?
It's a complex question, and I don't know. I guess I kind of change my mind about this from time to time. I mean, we're obviously seeing performers and artists of all types being willing to comment on their experiences of mental illness in a way that we would not have seen 20 years ago. Like, there's been a profound shift. And I think this is incredibly beneficial, especially for younger audiences. And I'm very hopeful that it does have an effect. that it does challenge stigma. Certainly there's less stigma attached to certain types of conditions. So we see less stigma attached to anxiety, for example, or postnatal depression. But I feel there's still stigma attached to forms of mental illness which are more complex, such as psychosis or persistent depression. And that there's also still stigmas associated with certain types of treatment. And my current research is actually in this area, looking at whether celebrity testimony of experiences of mental illness and treatment do actually have an effect on stigma. So I think there's still a lot of research to be done and questions to be asked about how effective it actually is.
Yeah, a very interesting topic indeed for us to know whether it is having a positive influence or not. So thank you very much, Fiona, for being with us today. It's been a pleasure and having you here today.
You are so welcome, Carmen. I really appreciate it.
So thank you for listening to this New Books Network interview with Fiona Gregory, author of Actresses and Mental Illness.